So today we're going to have Gintare Carolina Chibugaite. She is a research scientist at Element AI. Before that, she did her PhD in the University of Cambridge under the supervision of Sabin Garamani. Before that, she studied mathematics at the University of Warwick, and also she read part three in mathematics at the University of Cambridge, and because of that, she received a Master of Advanced Study in Applied Mathematics. And also, Carolina has had like positions in, and like has been a postdoc in the Institute for Advanced Study, and also has been affiliated with the Simons Institute for the Theory of Computing. And Carolina has been doing like very, very interesting work in the that uses like information theory and statistics in order to improve our understanding of generalization properties of usual algorithms that appear in deep learning. And it seems that that is what Carolina is going to talk about now. This talk is named Distribution Dependent Generalization Bounds for Noisy Iterative Learning Algorithms. And now I leave you with Carolina to tell us. Please,
Carolina. Thank you for the introduction, and thanks for the invitation to present my work. So I'm going to present my work that was done in collaboration with my intern Mehdi and my colleagues at the University of Toronto. So part of my research is centered around the following question. Can we derive meaningful generalization bounds for non-convex learning? And today I'll be focusing on stochastic gradient longitudinamics, or SGLD in short. So with SGLD, we minimize empirical risk, similarly as we do with stochastic gradient descent, iteratively, but on each iteration, we also add this additional Gaussian noise term, which makes the analysis quite a bit easier. Roginski, Rackman, and Talgarski a few years back gave first not asymptotic risk bounds for SGLD. So assuming that the learning rate eta goes to zero and the so-called inverse temperature parameter beta converges, SGLD samples from a Gibbs distribution, which is proportional to exponentiated and rescaled empirical risk. So looking at this picture, if we initialize our training at this X here, and run, for example, stochastic gradient descent or full batch gradient descent, it will most likely converge to this local minima close by. If we run SGLD instead, because it's sampling due to this additive Gaussian noise term, it will actually be exploring this other minimum quite a bit. Pensier, Jug, and Low, 3-4 years back, established generalization bands for SGLD using estimates of the mutual information between the weights at convergence and the data set, based on the information leaked at each iteration. Now, unfortunately, this yields vacuous bounds. But of course, they only used estimates of mutual information. So the question, does the mutual information between the weights of convergence and data set explains generalization, still remains. In our work, we show how gradient noise influences mutual information leading to non-vacuous bounds. So let me start by kind of, you know, defining the notation I'll be using throughout the talk and just introducing the setup. We'll denote by D the unknown data distribution on the inputs X and our binary labels. And we'll consider a parametric class of predictors FW that are parameterized by some W in a high dimensional space. The goal is then to find, the goal of learning really is to find some weights such that the probability of error is minimized. And we call this probability of error risk. Let S denote the training set, sampled ID from this unknown data distribution D. Then the empirical risk is defined as the average error on our training set. We'll denote with this tilted A, the algorithm that takes in training data S, and maybe some other randomness U, for example, mini-batch order, or maybe the randomness that's added to each mini-batch gradient, and W will denote the learn parameters. Now, straightforwardly, it's possible to decompose the risk into the following terms just by adding and subtracting empirical risk. So risk equals empirical risk plus risk minus empirical risk, so plus the difference between the two. And this difference between risk and empirical risk is called generalization error. So consider a parametric class of neural networks. For example, all neural networks of some particular width and depth and a particular activation function such as ReLU. Many of the most successful learning algorithms look superficially like approximations to empirical risk minimization. So usually we take our empirical risk and try to minimize it with respect to the parameters approximately. Then going back to the risk decomposition I introduced in the previous slide, that risk is empirical risk plus the generalization error, so the difference between risk and empirical risk, we can see that the first term, the empirical risk term, is small by design because we're explicitly minimizing it. But what controls the generalization error? So what controls the second term? The classical approach to controlling the generalization error term exploits uniform convergence. The key idea is quite simple. So again, risk, this decomposition equals empirical risk plus generalization error. And we can bound empirical risk is, of course, just computed on our training set. We don't need to estimate it in any way or bound it. But the second term, the generalization error, we can bound it in the worst case, based on the worst case generalization error of any model in a particular class and perhaps any data distribution. This approach works really well for small model classes, but not for explaining modern machine learning. So here's a classical textbook generalization story where on the x-axis we have the complexity of our hypothesis class and on the y-axis we have error. The empirical risk, which is this curve in blue, is of course decreases as we increase model complexity because we can fit the training better, data better and better. The risk, the green curve, initially decreases and in this classical picture starts increasing because we get too much complexity in our class. The difference between the two is the generalization error. And of course, it starts increasing later as well. Now, of course, this is not what happens in modern machine learning and in deep neural networks, for example. As we increase our complexity, as measured by, let's say, the number of layers or number of parameters, the training error, which is this black curve now, decreases, eventually goes to zero. And the test error, it doesn't go up. It keeps actually going down even after we fit all the training data. So this plot, I think, is taken from Nisha Baratal paper from 2015. So let's WB the weights learned by stochastic gradient descent. Then a uniform convergence bound could take the following form. We might want to bound the generalization error in expectation or with high probability in terms of some epsilon that may depend maybe on the hypothesis class we're using, number of samples we have, the probability with which the bound holds, data distribution, training set, algorithm we use, and so on. The fewer terms that epsilon that the bound depends on, the stronger the bound. So perhaps it can only depend on the hypothesis class, number of training data we have, and the probability of failure. And an example of such a bound is VC bound. So VC bound roughly takes the following form. And VC dimension of a hypothesis class for neural networks is again roughly lower bounded by the number of parameters. So for neural networks, let's take a tiny neural network trained on MNIST with a single hidden layer of 600 units. It would already have nearly 500,000 of parameters, which is a lot more than the number of training examples. And we can see that this bound depends on the ratio between the VC dimension and the number of training data. Of course, leading to a totally vacuous bound, meaning that the bound is much greater than one. Now, of course, one could say, we're here in this regime right now. For the number of data we have, the bound is way above one. We can get more data. Eventually, we'll arrive at a non-vacuous bound as the bound decreases the number of training points. But that's not what happens in practice. As we get more training data, we usually increase the model size, the complexity of the model. So we increase the size of the neural network, for example. Of course, the fact that the number of parameters is not really the right notion of complexity has been appreciated long ago. So here is the paper by Peter Bartlett from over 20 years ago, saying that the size of the weights is more important than the size of the network. Here is some more recent work by Nature by et al. Focusing on path norm instead of L2 norm on the weights. So instead of getting this bound, these papers kind of suggest that maybe we'll get a generalization bound that also depends on the norm of the weights, which will help us limit the hypothesis class we're looking at and perhaps get a tighter bound. So looking again at a simple network anamnest, we can evaluate these bounds. So we'll see that the bound depends on the path norm divided by the margin. The path norm, as the training progresses on the x-axis, it increases. The margin also increases, which is great because we care about the ratio of the two. But note that the path norm here is plotted on the y-axis on the log scale and margin is not. And so when you compute the bound, it as soon as the network starts doing something non-trivial, the bound will be totally vacuous. You know, one can argue that perhaps if we add explicit regularization, maybe it's useful as a regularizer. So as you start regularizing the path norm, it definitely grows slower. It doesn't grow as much anymore. But unfortunately, the margin also decreases and we still leading to a vacuous bound, sorry. As we increase the regularization we do, the path norm decreases, the margin decreases. And again, when you look at the ratio, perhaps we can get a bound that's below one now, but our predictor, and here's the training end test loss, is not doing that great. This is MNIST and we're getting 30% error. So it's not actually a useful predictor anymore. So summarizing the progress towards explaining generalization of stochastic gradient descent, I think we can conclude that no existing bounds explain deep learning in practice. Analytically, modern bounds are not asymptotic, but data-dependent terms are poorly understood. So if the bound includes any data-dependent terms, even like the norm of the weights actually after training data-dependent, we don't really understand how they grow, how they scale. Numerically, no bound on stochastic gradient descent on a real neural network is non-vacuous. And asymptotically, the bounds don't even scale correctly, like shown in the Garage and Coulter paper from last year or 2 years ago. It is hard to evaluate bounds empirically. Empirical correlation studies are usually unconvincing on close inspection. So there are papers that perhaps show that the bounds do not explain generalization and include some empirical evidence. Those are usually pretty convincing. But the papers that introduce a new bound and perform some kind of empirical correlation studies, if you actually look closer, those empirical correlation studies are not too convincing. In practice, suggestions made by Zhang et al.'s paper, fantastic generalization measures, have absolved authors of any serious consideration of empirical evidence. So there, they propose a single metric, which would allow for comparing different generalization measures. But I don't think that a single metric can actually capture the failures and successes of these measures. In our NeurIPS 2020 paper, in search of robust measures of generalization, which was in collaboration with researchers at MILA, ServiceNow and University of Toronto, we argue for a distributional robustness analysis. Now the analysis is not straightforward. It doesn't produce you a single quantity to look at and it's hard and subtle, but I think that when we want to understand generalization measures, we need a hard analysis. We can't conclude things with a single number. But one thing we do conclude in the paper is that no bound is actually robust, or no generalization measure is actually robust. The role of the data and key tools are more important than realized. Explanations must be data dependent, and we don't really have good tools for measuring kind of how hard the data is. Explanations must not argue why uniform convergence of a class containing the learned predictor. And this is really based on our recent work with Jeff Negrier and Dan Roy that appeared at ACML last year and the Garage and Coulter paper from a couple of years back. So what are the barriers to explaining generalization? Well, there are many. And here are a few that we'll be dealing with today. So one barrier is statistical. The bulk of empirical generalization performance may be due to properties of the unknown data distribution. And we only have samples to understand the true data distribution. Another barrier is computational. tight upper bounds on various divergences like KL or mutual information are often intractable. Also, the bounds depend on marginal probabilities and sampling. Those are also intractable. So why does non-convex learning with stochastic gradient longitudinal dynamics generally? So we'll go back now to the question I presented in the first slide. Are there any questions at this point? I also forgot to mention that if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me.
Yeah, there are questions so far in the chat, but please feel free to ask in the chat and then I can ask Carolina.
Okay, so I'll continue for now. And yeah, just interrupt me if you have any questions. So here is the update of SGLD, just as a reminder. It's a standard update based on the gradient of the empirical risk plus a Gaussian noise term. Now, this additional noise term actually makes SGLD much easier to analyze compared to SGD. The beta is referred to as the inverse temperature parameter. It trades off exploration versus optimization. So as we increase the beta, we'll be adding less noise and we'll be getting closer to standard stochastic gradient descent. And as we decrease beta, we'll be adding more noise and doing more exploration. There are two views of SGLD that one can take. One is the sampling view that, as I mentioned before, we can see SGLD as sample, producing samples from a Gibbs distribution. But unfortunately, this only holds under unrealistic assumptions. The second view is that it optimizes empirical risk and resulting weights don't carry too much information about the data S. Now, does this latter view explain generalization? So let S be the training data just as before, W the learned weights by stochastic gradient Langevin dynamics. We'll denote the by EGE, the expected generalization error. So the expected difference between risk and empirical risk. Assume that the loss is bounded between 0 and 1, though this assumption can be relaxed, but it's just easier to keep this in mind for the talk. Jürgen Roginski a few years back showed that expected generalization error is bounded above in terms of square root of the mutual information between the weights and the data divided by the amount of data we have. For those that are more used to thinking in terms of KL divergences rather than mutual information, we can also write down mutual information in terms of the KL. So let B be the marginal distribution of the weights and Q be the distribution of the weights given the training set. Then the mutual information is the expected KL divergence between this Q and P. So does this theorem bounding the expected generalization error in terms of mutual information explain generalization of SGLD? There are a couple of barriers again. One is statistical. Mutual information between the weights and the data depends on the unknown data distribution. And another barrier is computational. So even if the data distribution were known, P and Q are often intractable, meaning that the mutual information between the data and the weights is also intractable. So how can we get around these barriers, the computational barrier? Let ST denote random mini batches of our training set S. Stochastic gradient longitudinal dynamics adds this, at each step adds this Gaussian noise term, which seems actually nice for analysis. And Fancier, Jog, and Low take advantage of this. So they observe that the chain rule on mutual information applies that the mutual information between the weights and the data can be bounded in terms of the sum of mutual informations that measure the information leaked at each step. So here's a conditional mutual information conditioning on the weights of the previous step and computing the information between the mid-batch used for the update and the current weights. So information leaked about the data by the final weights at convergence is bounded above by the sum of information leaked about each mid-batch at each training set. Now, of course, you know, we kind of simplified the problem. Instead of thinking about kind of the weights of convergence, we are thinking about them stepwise. But the next hurdle is to compute this stepwise mutual information, which is also unknown and intractable. So again, we had these statistical and computational barriers.
Carolina?
So, yes.
Sorry, like there is a question in the chat.
Yeah.
Asked now by Kia Wei. who says, when talking about BC dimension bounds, you mentioned that we can just use more data because that would also imply a larger model size. Could you elaborate on that? Can we theoretically show that the BC dimension bound doesn't hold when the data size is larger than the model size?
No, so it does hold. It does hold when, so for example, if we fix the neural network and keep getting more and more data, eventually we'll get a non-vacuous bound. But actually, if you actually look at the numerical quantities we have, in order to get a non-vacuous bound, we'll need a very, very large amount of data. Mm-hmm. Okay, which is just not reasonable, not practical. Mm-hmm. And I think what I was trying to say there is that when we get more data, instead of looking at the same model and looking at how this model performs and getting bounds for it, we actually look at a larger network instead. We get more data, we again scale up the model size, right? So we never really, you know, as we get more data, we don't keep looking at the same small network anymore. And that's what I really meant. But no, VC bounds are still valid, and eventually they'll give you non-vacuous bounds. But it's just unreasonable to expect that, you know, unreasonable even for the small networks we have to demand to have this much data, really. Okay, so getting around this other computational learning statistical barrier for a one-step conditional mutual information. Okay. So ST are mini batches from S. At each step, we add Gaussian noise, and this Gaussian noise makes our analysis actually much easier. So WT plus one, conditioned on where we are at time T, WT, is actually Gaussian, because of this additive Gaussian noise term. So it has mean centered at this update, so WT minus the gradient of the empirical risk. And the covariance is, of course, determined by the scaled Gaussian term we're adding here. So it's always fixed. We actually always know the covariance. To know the mean, we would have to know the mini batch. Now this single step mutual information intuitively is expected log loss of best predictor for WT plus one based only on WT. So of course, if we choose any other predictor for WT plus one, we'll get an upper bound on the mutual information. So for example, we can predict that WT plus one is sampled from a Gaussian that's centered at our current weights WT with the right covariance matrix, which is known. Then we can bound the mutual information just in terms of the expected squared norm or the gradient. Alternatively, we could predict that we sample WT plus one from a Gaussian that's centered at current weights minus the update based on the gradient of the risk. Of course, risk depends on the unknown data distribution. So again, this is not tractable, but just as an example, we would get that the mutual information then is bounded in terms of the expected norm, squared norm of the difference between the empirical risk gradient and the risk gradient. Okay, so just because of this additive Gaussian noise, we can make these kind of nice guesses on the distribution that WT plus one is sampled from. And Pensei, Jog, and Low take advantage exactly of this. So they assume that the supremum, they bound the supremum of the gradient of the empirical risk in terms of the Lipschitz constant of the empirical risk. Then plugging it back in here and optimizing the variances, they get the bound on this one-step mutual formation in terms of this Lipschitz constant squared. Now combining this with the chain rule on the mutual information, they get the following bound. So expected generalization error is bounded in terms of this mutual information by which was shown by Zhu and Roginsky. But now they bound this to make it more tractable in terms of the squared Lipschitz constant. And there's summing over training times from that comes from this chain rule. Okay, So in summary, Pensia, Jog, and Low, they bound the mutual information between the weights of convergence of data in terms of information leaked at each training step. This information leaked at each training step is unknown. It's actually still distribution dependent, but they bound it via Lipschitz continuity. So they lose distribution dependence. So this approach yields a distribution independent bound. And for deep neural networks, the Lipschitz constant for the empirical risk is actually massive. And as a rule of thumb, bounds depending on this Lipschitz constant are usually vacuous in the regimes of interest. So can we do better? So Pensia, Jog, and Low, they don't really know what the data distribution with, and they're not dealing with it. You know, in some cases, it might be, this is just one step of usual data, can be, the gradient can be really spread around depending on the minibatch you get, and other times it can be more concentrated. Without knowing the data distribution, we don't know in which scenario we are. So in our work, we propose to use some of the data to estimate which case we're dealing with. Let J be denote a random subset of your training set. So the training set S is now split into SJ and SJ bar, selected randomly. Now one can show that expected generalization error is then bounded by this conditional mutual information between the weights and SJ bar, conditioned on the other set SG. But of course, now we're dividing here by the smaller number, by this other set SG bar, the size of the set. Letting Q be the distribution of the weights conditioned on the data, and B be the distribution of the weights conditioned only on the set SG. So it's similar as before, but instead of P being the marginal on W, they're conditioning on the subset of the data. So I'll refer to Q as the posterior and P as the prior sometimes. This conditional mutual information can be expressed again as the expected KL divergence, but not between Q and data independent P, but between Q that depends on S and P that depends on the subset of the data SG. So you can think about it as P being a data dependent prior. Then we show that expected generalization error is bounded above by this expectation of the square root of this KL divergence between the posterior and a data-dependent prior. And this, of course, holds for all kernels P. We might just get a looser bound if we make not a good choice for P. So let WT denote iterates for our training. And define these conditional distributions, one-step distribution. So kind of similarly as before, Q, T given T minus one, the distribution on WT given all the previous iterates actually. And similarly, PT given T minus one, be a distribution on, again, WT given our previous location and the subset of the data, so not the full data. Then these one-step distributions are both Gaussian and satisfy the following equation. So they're both Gaussian, the same variances, because the variance only depends on the additive Gaussian term, but different means. So for the Q, the mean depends on the previous location minus the gradient of the empirical risk computed on all of the training set S, and the mean of P is similar, but the gradient of empirical risk is computed only on the subset of the data SG that the prior has access to. Now, from here, I think it's quite clear to see where we're going with this. So the chain rule for KL yields that KL between Q and P at convergence is upper bounded in terms of the sum of these expected stepwise scales. So now we're only computing the KL distribution between this conditional Q and conditional P after one step, and Q and P are Gaussians. So of course the scale works out to be, can be computed easily. So the one step KL divergence is then equal to this term. So beta inverse temperature, eta learning rate, and the squared norm of the zeta, which we call incoherence, which measures how different our gradient on all the data is from the gradient on the subset of the data. And here, note that we are averaging over which subset of the data we are computing. Okay, any questions here?
I don't see any question in the chat.
Okay. So to summarize kind of all these bounds, here is Pensi et al. Bound. Here's another bound that appeared soon after theirs by Mo et al. And this is our bound. And the key difference is between these highlighted terms in red. So Pensi et al. Bound depends on the Lipschitz continuity term. Mo et al. Bound depends on the norm of the gradients, which can still be very large during training. And our bound depends on this incoherence term, the norm of the incoherence term, which is the difference between gradient on all the batch versus gradient on the mini batches. In practice, incoherence term turns out to be quite a bit smaller. So here we plot incoherence term versus the norm of the full gradient for different number of held out points, meaning held out from the prior. So really how many points did the prior did not see? So it's the size of SG bar in the language before. And here one should compare, for example, this blue line with the orange line, which has the same number of held out points. Sorry, am I right? Let's see. Let's start with red and green. So red and green. So our term, the incoherence term is green, and the term appearing at Mo et al. Bound is in red. And we can see that it's orders of magnitude larger. And again, for a different choice of number of held out points, we can compare the blue and the orange. And again, we can see that the blue, which is our incoherence term, is much, much smaller. Looking at the bounds itself, yeah.
Umut is asking, could you tell us what's the data and the architecture for this experiment?
Yeah, great question. I did not take a note on this one. It's either CIFAR or NEMNIST. On these, I'm pretty sure that this was NEMNIST and this one was CIFAR. So I'll have to look this one up from the paper and just quickly grab a screenshot. But this one was, I think, NEMNIST, or actually they're both CIFAR. You know what? I should have taken a note. I apologize. But it's one of the two. So here is the actual bound. And here we see the Mo et al. Bound, their bound, but with a different choice of the inverse temperature parameter. So here is then the inverse temperature is large, meaning that we have less exploration. Inverse temperature is small, meaning that we have more exploration. And here for the same choices of, this is not inverse temperature, this is the learning rate. This was inverse temperature. I accidentally switched the slides. And here our bounds with the same choices of inverse temperature parameters. And we can see that, again, they're quite a bit smaller. And here we're varying the learning rate instead of the inverse temperature. And again, these two are Mo et al. Bounds and these two are our bounds. Here I labeled it. So here's MNIST, fashion, MNIST, and CIFAR. And here we have the incoherence term, the norm, squared norm of the incoherence term in red, and the size of the gradient, again, squared norm of the gradient in blue. And we can see again that, you know, the x-axis is in log scale, and that for all three data sets, our incoherence term as orders of magnitude smaller.
Karina, Lyle is asking, just to clarify, what you're describing are bounds on the generalization error or the generalization gap?
Yeah, so here are, here we are only, in this plot, we are only computing the incoherence term and the norm term, which appear in the bound. And the here it was the bound on the expected generalization error, so the difference between the risk and empirical risk. But this particular plot is just the kind of the we're tracking the actual term that appears in the patent.
Yeah, I think that it was like related to the previous slide. So
yeah, thanks. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Now, the question that remains is, can we actually learn from past iterates? Because now we only looked one step back. So we reduce the problem of thinking about the distribution of the weights at convergence to the conditional of the weights at time t, given the previous set of weights of wire chain rule. We improved upon the worst case bound on the one step KL mutual information via data dependent estimates that led to the great incoherence term. At each time step t, we did not take advantage of the past iterates W naught WT minus one that may reveal information about the unknown to the prior data points as J bar. So as the prior does not see C as J bar, but it can kind of get information about S J bar by looking at this past iterates that we are allowed to condition on. So we should be able to leverage information from past iterates to make better predictions for WT. We implement this idea using an improved version of the information theoretic bounds introduced by Spanke and Zakynthou just last year. So consider a so-called supersample. So this particular supersample is 2 by n, and this was the size of our training set, but now we're imagine just sampling double that. And now we choose our training set S from the supersample by in each column by choosing randomly the first entry or the second entry. Let ui be equal to 1 if S contains the first data point out of the ith column, and ui equal to 2 if the training set contains the second entry from the ith column. So for example, if we have u, which is this vector of ones and twos in it, it gives us a training set sampled uniformly at random. It gives us a training set that chooses the first entry from the first column. It chooses the second entry from the second column. It chooses again the first entry from the third column, and so on. So Stanka and Zakynthou define the conditional mutual information of an algorithm A with respect to a data distribution as CMI of the algorithm A equals this conditional mutual information between the weights and the index which you use to choose a training set, given the supersample. And it might be easier actually to think of this mutual information in the following way. So it being as a mutual information between the weights and the training set, given the supersample. Now, CMI has some really nice properties. So they show that CMI is bounded, always bounded. K was the number of rows in the supersample, and N is the size of the training set. Now, in contrast, standard mutual information can actually be infinite. What we show is that CMI is actually always no greater than the mutual information. So going back to the kind of this, the original bound on expected generalization error by in terms of the mutual information. Stanke and Zakynthou prove a new upper bound in terms of the conditional mutual information. So this is just CMI. Notice that you have some slightly different constants here. And in our work, we show that for J chosen independently at random from our training set. So let's say we choose one index J, then expected generalization error is bounded in terms of this individual sample bound that I'll explain in the next slide. And it's tighter than the original CMI bound. So this was the original CMI bound in, from the line above that appeared in Stanke and Zakynthou paper. And we prove a slightly tighter bound in terms of this individual sample bound. So let me just kind of give you a little bit of intuition what this individual sample bound is and what this term even means, which we call disintegrated mutual information. So this is actually a random variable. So let UJ indicate which of terms in the super sample in the jth column was used to train W, so just as before. Then this disintegrated mutual information is mutual information between the weights and the indicator UJ, known the super sample and the index J. So in effect, our bound pulls two expectations outside the square root. So here you see the original bound and that appeared in Stank and Zakintha new paper, which can be expressed in terms of this expectation of disintegrated mutual information. And we're just here, you can think about this term as the average over which index J we're using. And our bound is kind of roughly, you know, pulling these expectations outside the square root. So you see the expectation appearing here, which means a bound tighter by Jensen's and so on. So for Langevin dynamics, individual sample bound leads to two sample incoherence. So I will not go through the details that are somewhat too complicated for the talk, but if you kind of, you know, similarly as in the previous case, you can actually show that this two sample bound leads to the following two sample incoherence. So instead of measuring, before we had the incoherence measuring the difference between the gradient of empirical risk on all the training set versus on the subset of the training set, the two sample incoherence measures the difference of the gradient of empirical risk on one sample from the super sample versus another sample from the super sample in this jth column. And then it's averaging over j's. So conditioning on all but the jth entry in the training set S, how much information do the weights at the end of training reveal about which of the two samples, Z1j or Z2j, belong in the training set? So naively, we could assign equal probability to each sample appearing in the training set. And if we had no further information, that's of course all we can do. And we'll end up incurring the penalty that depends on the squared norm of two sample incoherence. But don't forget that we have access to all the previous iterates, W1 to WT minus one. After observing them, predicting identity of the jth entry can be viewed as a binary classification problem. Informally, the lower the risk of this prediction, the tighter the bound, reducing the penalty. So, you know, the weights W, the past iterates W1 to WT minus one were being updated based on training on the full training set S. So each time we get a little bit of information about which of the data points appear. And indeed, this leads to a much better approach. So we can see that in the beginning of training, so this is MNIST and CIFAR, x-axis is the number of training steps and y-axis is the error, and we're plotting the bound. So in the beginning of the training, you can see that our old bound, which is the green, and our new bound, which is the blue, they kind of do approximately the same because the new bound hasn't yet, the incoherence term is equally large because you haven't learned too much from early iterates. But as the training goes, you're learning more and more about which of the two samples from the super sample actually belong in the training set. And the penalty coming from the norms of the incoherence term is actually, you know, going to zero and the bound converges. And this is yet another bound that appeared in 2020 by some other authors. So to recap and summarize all what I talked about today, so I discussed the barriers to explaining generalization in deep learning and highlighted the need of proper empirical evaluation and data dependence. And, you know, thinking about what tools we need to kind of measure data dependence, I think it will be key to improving to getting tighter bounds. I introduced mutual information bounds and expected generalization error due to Zhu-Maginsky. I described application to understanding stochastic gradient longitudinal dynamics. Also mentioned the work by Pensi et al. That used mutual information between the data S and the weights W learned by SGOD. And they bound the mutual information between these by the information leaked at each iteration instead. So they break down the problem of thinking about the weights of convergence to kind of one step ahead. I explained that distribution independent bounds on information leakage, as done in Pensi et al, yield vacuous bounds in its standard regimes. I introduced distribution dependence via Kale bounds and data dependent priors, and presented empirical findings showing that gradient incoherence is much smaller than gradient norms, for example. We're still getting clues, but not vacuous bounds for the first few epochs, and the bound unfortunately kept increasing as the training went on. One point that I didn't add here, I also talked about how we can use conditional mutual information, CMI, so work by Stank and Zickenthaneu, in order to learn a little more about the held out points from the prior, from the previous iterates, in order for the bound to actually converge instead of keep increasing. More work is needed to understand the limits of mutual information-based explanations of SGLD, since all of these are just estimates, all of these are bounds. And I think there's a lot more work to be done in order to tighten these up. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I'm uploading in on behalf of all the audience. There is a question in the chat by Umut as well. Who says the incoherence term looks like of order D. Have you conducted experiments to see how the new bounds behave with increasing D? For example, increasing the number of layers, the width, etc. They increase as well?
So we did not do experiments in our most recent paper. I'm thinking if we did in our NURBS 2019 paper. I think we did experiment with different architectures. The incoherence term, of course, only implicitly depends on it, right? Because it depends on the norm of the gradients, or you know, the difference between the norms of the gradients. And I can't really answer this question, but I think it's just one of those things, as I said initially, we don't really have a good way to think about these data-dependent quantities and how these scale. So I think it's an interesting question. But I haven't thought enough about it, but I think we may have included some experiments in the 2019 NURBS paper on the information theoretic generalization bounds for iterative algorithms. So it might be worth checking there, but okay. Great question though.
Okay, I have a couple of questions. I'm not seeing anything else, but like we still have some minutes. So I felt like a very elementary question about like this coherence, which looks like a very relevant quantity, but at the same time, like doesn't seem at least like a priori similar to things that I'm familiar with in this literature. So I wonder if you have like a way of like explaining this quantity that appears in your bound that is like relates to any like a more familiar statistical concept. That is one question, and the other one is you don't talk much about this, but like I have like this paper in search of these robust measures of generalization. And I would like to know like how then would you like use these data dependence bounds if you like are trying to basically also like have like a narrative that includes like robustness to changes in distribution. Like, can you briefly like talk about that too?
Okay, so I'm worried I'll forget the first question, so I'll go back to the first. So you were asking for more intuition about the incoherence terms, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, you can really think about it as, in some sense, kind of variance of the gradients, right? Yeah. So if you have a distribution such that every time you get like a new sample, your gradient will be pointing in a very different direction, right? This incoherence term will be large, mm-hmm. Because your data will not, like small samples of the data will not be agreeing on where the minimum is. versus if you have kind of a, you know, and in some terms, it's like the niceness of the data, right? If you have a nice data distribution, then the incoherence term will be like, sorry, every gradient measured on a fairly small batch will roughly agree where the minimum is, and the incoherence term will be small, the norm of it, right? So it's really thinking about this kind of spread of the next gradient step. Mm-hmm. So that's my intuition, like think in terms of this kind of the spread of the gradients or the variance of the gradients, and mm-hmm. not so much about the, you know, the norms of the gradients or things like that that appeared in previous work, which I think is a big step forwards. Mm-hmm. So does this answer kind of yeah. question? Mm-hmm. And the second question was about in search of robust measures, search of yeah. robust measures of generalization. Yeah. What was the question again?
You talk about like that paper, you're like starting to like create like a narrative of like understanding like generalization in terms of like understanding robustness yeah. distribution. So I would like to know what is like the program that you have in terms of like using this data dependent bounds in addition to this like a narrative of like robustness.
Yeah. So you know the framework that we propose there, the distributional robustness framework, it just really we argue that the bounds have to be evaluated in different settings, so different what we call different environments there. For example, you know. I think it's unlikely that we'll get tight bounds that are not distribution dependent or hold in all possible scenarios. So as we vary the hyperparameters, as we vary the size of the architectures, as we vary the data sets, right? And what we argue there is that in order to understand when the bound fails, when it succeeds, you need to kind of define this set of environments where you think the bound should hold. Mm-hmm. For example, I think it will hold for, you know, small learning rates and when my architecture sizes are of a particular whatever. And then you want to really look at its worst performance under the set of environments. So that's really what the paper is about. Mm-hmm. And since none of the bounds are really, or none of the measures coming from the bounds are that great right now, one needs to really look further where they fail. And we actually, by looking kind of further and digging deeper through the framework of distributional robustness, we can identify some of the failures that were pointed out in the Garage and Coulter paper. For example, we noticed that when you have, I'm forgetting exactly actually the exact failure, but I think maybe it was when you have like a small number of training points, as you increase the training points, the bound was basically changing in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So there are things like that. And especially for all these bounds that involve data dependent quantities, I think just like a proper investigation and analysis over different environments is extremely important. Looking at the worst case here over those environments. Mm-hmm. Because if you claim that, you know, your bound will work well in kind of all these settings, but then you only look at the average performance over these settings, I don't mm-hmm. think it's a fair comparison, because a theory should kind of do equally well in each of the settings rather than on average. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how clear it was about the actual paper and the blogs, right. But mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm not seeing more questions in the chat. So thanks again to Carolina for this like very interesting talk.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And yeah, if you have any other questions or want to discuss any other related work, please feel free to reach out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.